I'm Sarah Cavanaugh, and this is Peaceful Exit, the podcast where we talk to creatives about life and death. You know, I love poetry, and this conversation surprised me. It broke me down, and then it put me back together, and it filled me with something like hope, or at least the ability to hold both hope alongside grief. Rosemary Watala Traumer is an amazing, prolific poet. She writes a poem every day, and I even asked her, do you really write a poem every day? And indeed, she does. She loves metaphor, and she talks about them in a really interesting way because some of our metaphors no longer serve us, and we need to think of new metaphors. And she also invents words in a time that needs new vocabulary. Rosemary's son and dad died in the same year, and much like her latest book, The Unfolding, this interview is in the key of grief, as she says. And although there is so much grief here, there is also so much praise. Hi, Rosemary. Welcome to Peaceful Exit.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you. So nice to meet you.
What really struck me about your book was sort of this inquiry around acceptance and how we accept exits that aren't peaceful. And you had one in your life and you lost your father and your son on the same year, as I understand.
Yeah, my dad maybe did have, I suppose, was certainly a much more peaceful exit than my son did, which is to say that my mom and my brother and I were all around him for days as he was dying. And how special that was, how lucky, beautiful to be present as he moved from resistance to acceptance himself, and to do it all together was such a gift. And so different than the trauma of losing a child by suicide. Or as I prefer to say, he chose to take his own life. And that was, as you say, that was not peaceful, Sarah. And so it's been a very different kind of journey, I guess, for many reasons.
Yeah.
But that's certainly one of them.
So let's talk about your dad just for a minute. Was he home?
Yes, although they had just moved to Georgia. So they had been there for 3 months. In mm-hmm. fact, that's where we had been helping them move into their new home when Finn took his life, also in the same place, into a kind of a senior living area. And so he was not in their actual home, but in a building that was connected to their apartments, a skilled nursing center. So it was as close to home as possible, I suppose. He had wonderful care and I think felt surrounded by love. I know he felt that.
Do you have siblings?
Just my younger brother, the two of us, and there we were, our small family connected in those moments, which, you know, it happens so rarely for the OG, right? The original four Watolas to be together, just us, without extended family. And that was really special, moving, precious.
And you were probably felt like you were able to say everything you wanted to say before he left.
Yes, I did feel like that. We had days, many hours that I just got to sit with him. And some of that time he was very lucid and some of it he wasn't. And I could just be with him, which was, I think, forgive me. Although, don't, I know you're really fine with me crying, but it occurs to me, Sarah, that I talk a lot about my son's death, but not so much about my father's. So it's interesting to feel how I'm just noticing in real time that maybe there's some softening that happens the more that we talk about it. And I just can tell how there's more rawness around this grief which is surprising to me.
It makes sense.
At the last moment, I went and grabbed a roll of toilet paper. Thank goodness.
It makes sense because so much attention has been paid to your son's death, and you've written about your son's death, and we'll get to that. We'll get to your book and your poems. But there's not as much in this book about your dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk for a minute about creating words. I'm shifting a little bit into your book. I feel like in this time, as words are being censored, it takes courage to step into creating language. And I think that's our next call. It's like, what are the words we're going to create for the world we want to see?
Yeah.
And you've done this, and these four beautiful words around praise. Can you talk a little bit about the process for creating words at this time when things seem to be, or some people seem to be, wanting to take words out of our language? How do we put words back into our language?
Right. And I want to just start with, I think, part of your premise, which is how do we envision the world we most want to be part of? And how does language help us do that? And it's true, I think, that sometimes words feel sorely lacking, and maybe they always will be. You know, I say the word tree, and it's never going to be a tree. It's always a word. It's never the tree itself, right? I write a poem about how much I love my daughter. It is never my daughter, right? It's just the poem pointing to the daughter. And yet there's something so powerful about that act of imagination, that act of creation, that strengthens our bond to the world and strengthens our clarity about what it is to be alive, or invites us deeper into the mystery of what it is to be alive, so we can steep there. And more than anything, language is connection. It is how we connect with the world around us. It's how we form our own ideas. It's how we reach to other people and communicate and receive it back. When we think of language in this way, as an infinite curiosity, as an infinite invitation to wonder, that's when language is its most helpful. And I think when it's its most dangerous is when we have a word and we say, this is it, and this is the only, and it becomes a little prison instead of a doorway. So then to part two, I think, of your question was about these words that I used in my new book, The Unfolding, and I created four new words for praise: Veriluya, Sarum, Pangloria, and Samunion. Those are all words that are blends, neologisms, new words that try to touch the complexity of what it really is to be alive, which is to exist at the same time in a world that is full of both joy and sorrow, and to know that they're not mutually exclusive, to know that just because we're praising something doesn't mean that we like it all the time, or that we're not surrounded by things that we don't particularly like. For instance, my idea with this word, pangloria, pan, the Greek word for all, gloria meaning glory, and the idea that there is praise available to us in absolutely everything, even the things where it's at first difficult to find it.
And I think this time calls for us for holding both. We're all holding both. Okay, a little context setting for our shift here to your poetry. We're going to be reading poems, mostly from your latest book, The Unfolding. But we're also going to look at some poems from your daily writing practice, which I understand you've been writing a daily poem since 2006. Is that correct?
That's correct. February of 2006. So
that's a long time.
It's a really long time, isn't it?
And is
that's
it actually
so many thousands of poems?
Is it actually every day, or do you ever miss a day?
Oh, friend, I don't ever miss a day, except there are two exceptions. I didn't write for, I don't know, a couple of months after my second child was born, after Vivian was born. And then I didn't write for 49 days, 7 weeks after Finn died.
Let's talk about Finn for a minute. Can you give us a little context of, as people are reading your poems, because I want them to run out and buy your book, give us a little context about what happened.
So Finn was, he brought an enormous amount of light to the world. He had just this kind of sparkling personality. He was ridiculously talented in almost, I mean, he sounds unreal sometimes when I talk about him, how he, you know, learned how to do backflips on his skis and built his own computers with all kinds of colors in them so they'd also be aesthetically pleasing. And he, you know, won the fencing tournament and he won the chess tournament and he won the invention fair. And he just had this kind of brilliant mind and laughed a lot. But he also, I think, brought all that light because he was almost always in pain. And that was something that he began to exhibit the moment he came out into the world. He cried for that whole first year. And, you know, I took him to every kind of doctor, chiropractor, naturopath, just everything we could think of, and people couldn't find out what was wrong, why he was clearly hurting. His first word was shadow. Like, not mama, dada, cat. It was shadow. A two-syllable word about an abstract thing. It was never easy to be Finn Dromer in the world somehow. And his first time that he began talking about wanting to take his life was in sixth grade. And we immediately got him lots of help with therapists and kind of a life coach and acupuncture. And that's when we began the fencing lessons. I mean, we changed his school and anything we could do to address him and help him find a way to be here. So it wasn't a surprise, you know, it wasn't out of nowhere when he chose to take his life in August of 2021. And he had been really hurting. He also, the day before he took his life, he had just been accepted into a new school who had just told him over and over how much they wanted him and how grateful they were that he was going to be coming, and they were showering him with praise. I think it helps me, Sarah, to know that he knew that he had options here. It wasn't like every door had closed for him. You know, it helps me to know in a way that there's no doubt in my mind that that boy knew how loved he was. And still, he was somehow suffering so much that this is the choice that he made. So when we were in Georgia helping my mom and dad move into their new home, my father's guns were not locked. And they were, you know, being moved. So this is how he found a way to do it.
What's coming up for me is your ability to speak about it. And only it feels in all of your writing and all of your metabolizing of what is unspeakable. Are you able to sit here and share with me? How much do you feel like your poetry, your writing has helped you through this?
Oh, Sarah. Well, enormously. There's no doubt about that. But not just after the fact, before the fact too. Which is to say that through all those difficult years, I had writing as a way to meet what it was like to be a parent of a child who was brilliant and hurting. And I had a daily practice already in place for, what, at that point, 15 years of showing up to wonder what's here. So that I think that the real gift of that practice, though I would have never said so at the time, and I only can say so now in retrospect, is that when things fell apart, I still had a habit of showing up. So that even when I wasn't writing poems for those first 7 weeks after he died, I still had this impulse to be present. I still had this longing to feel. I remember people saying, you don't actually have to feel at all. And I wanted to more than anything. I wanted to feel it. I wanted to feel the deepest ache of it. When I did begin writing poems again, I do believe, Sarah, that getting to explore my relationship to him and how the poems help that relationship continue to grow, because I'm writing him letters about this is what's happening. This is what it's like to love you now. This is what it's like in the world now that you're not here physically, but you're still here in every way, right? You're still here.
I love what you say about how you love him now. And I was wondering, you clearly have a way with words. You're a professional poet, but what about the rest of us? What if we don't have a daily writing practice?
You don't need to be a poet or even like poems to allow writing to be a companion for you as you grieve. One of the greatest gifts that a poem can offer us is that it embraces paradox. My invitation to myself is always to write something true. It doesn't have to be good. It just has to be true. And that I just let a poem be made up of lines, one after another. What's the next true thing? What's the next true thing? And if I can write something true, then the next invitation is to write the exact opposite and see if it's also true. If you have a story that you're telling yourself, I should have done this, then allow yourself to write that because, of course, that's how you're feeling. And then allow yourself to write the exact opposite. I should not have fill in the blank. And see if there's any way that that could also be true. And in this way of seeing, just inviting up this paradox, it helps to open us up. Again, there's that word, opening. And actually, I have a poem that exemplifies this that I'd love to share with you. The poem is called Two Truths. He is dead. Never again to pull on the fencing mask, moonwalk to his bedroom, or snuggle on the couch. Not dancing on the stage. He is dead. Not spinning the gator through the field, not graphing equations for pleasure. Is he dead? Asks the heart. No. He lives on forever. In the scent of lemon, in the cloudy ice on the pond, in the buds of the lilac tree, in the song on my breath, he lives. In blue sky and comet and field, he lives in ink and in spaces between. He is dead. I held his unbreathing body in my arms. Since that day, he has never left me. He is alive forever. So we take these phrases, he's dead. Is he dead? No, he's alive forever. Are they both true? They're both true. Oh, Sarah, and then I had this profound experience. Actually, I wrote a poem about this too. That poem and this one too are both from All the Honey. Okay, so this poem is called The Invitation. Two nights after he died, all night I heard the same one-line story on repeat. I am the woman whose son took his life. The words felt full of self-pity, filled me with hopelessness, doom. And then a voice came, a woman's voice just before dawn, and it gave me a new shade of truth. I am the woman who learns how to love him now that he's gone. It did not change the facts, but it changed everything about how I met the facts. Over 100 days later, over 3 years later, I am still learning what it means to love him. How love is an ocean, a wildfire, a crumb. How commitment to love changes me, changes everyone, invites us to bring our best. Love is wine, is trampoline, is an infinite song with a chorus in which I am sung. I am the woman who learns how to love him now that he's gone. May I always be learning how to love, like a cave, like a rough-legged hawk, like a sun.
So visiting the place where your son died, you wrote two poems. One is in the new book. How do you feel about reading both of them, or just the one in the new book?
Yeah, both of them. I'm happy to read them both. The first time that I went back, Sarah, was when my father, I didn't yet know he was dying, but it was 3 months after Finn died. My dad was in skilled nursing. It was my mother's 75th birthday. So I was determined to go back. And neither my husband nor my daughter felt like they were capable of that, which, of course, I understood. And I knew that it was asking a lot of me to go back to that place, which the only experience I have with that place was helping them move in and then this enormous loss. So there was no happy memories to help soften what that place represented to me. And then just in the last few months, it was my mother's birthday again, and I told my daughter that I was going to be going, and she said, could I come with you this time? And I said, yeah, of course. And I'll do everything I can to keep you safe as you do that. When we went back, for Vivian, what she most needed was to not go back to that room where he had died. And by the way, she was the one who had found him there. And I understood that completely and knew why it was important for her, even if she stayed in that same little apartment, to not go back to that space. And the opposite is true for me, that for me, I need to go sit in that same exact spot on the floor where he died and be there. So I think first, I'll read the poem that's about my first time going back to that space. And then I'll read the poem about going back after that with Vivian. I didn't think I could do it. But I found myself rigid in the room where my son took his life. And I sat on the floor in the doorway where he had last sat, where his blood had pooled and the air had briefly smelled of burning. I sat there, beneath the wall where the bullet had made its narrow hole. I sat there with my coil of sorrow. I didn't want to meet it. I desperately wanted to meet it. I wanted to give sorrow space. I wanted to crawl inside it. I wanted to be anywhere but there on the dark wood floor in the night dark room. And I wanted to be wholly, completely, obliteratingly there, fear-ridden, ferocious. I met it all. Felt the current pushing through. Acceptance is a filament that takes our resistance and makes it bright. Makes it luminous enough that we might see ourselves exactly as we are. I did not find my son in that doorway. Perhaps I had hoped I would. But I saw the light that came with me. I softened into that light. I think in that poem, you can really hear that interplay of those opposites, like we were talking about before with the paradox. I didn't want to meet it. I desperately wanted to meet it. I wanted to give it space. I wanted to crawl inside it. I wanted to be anywhere but there, and I wanted to be completely there. And both of those equally true as I was experiencing that for the first time. And then 3 years later, going back to that same spot. So then this poem, visiting the place where my son died. Please, I tell myself, don't take this lightly. Don't walk into this room as if it's just another room. Come with reverence, please. I say to myself, all of myself, please don't stride across this wooden floor as if it isn't the last place your son brought the world into his lungs, the last place he loved and ached and wept. So I sit and breathe until I feel it rise in my chest how sacred it is, this place. I sit here until I feel my attention split. I notice the urge to leave. I choose again to stay. And the choice baptizes me. Please, I say to myself, please slow to the pace of stone. Nothing to do but be here. And the crying comes and goes and comes again and goes. I close my eyes and let the shadows grow. Then open my eyes and look beyond the window to the sky, the cliffs, the lake. Please, I tell myself, do not refuse to see it is beautiful. What is the part of me that dies? And what is the part that rises, slow and new, to walk again into the world?
As you were reading, I could see you create a really beautiful vision around the sacredness of those spaces where people die, honoring that space. And it's terrifying as well.
Oh, yeah. All those feelings, all those big, horrible feelings. Yeah, it's terrifying.
I've talked to other parents who've lost children, and you put words to experiences that are very hard to articulate. Impossible, really. That's why poetry feels like the exact right art form, because poetry doesn't pretend to articulate things. And I'd love for you to read "They Asked If We Had More Children."
After I told them about our two daughters, they asked if we had more children. There's no easy way to say it, I told them. Our son died. They were sitting across from us, our new neighbors, afternoon sun streaming into the room with low spring gold. Their grandson sat on the floor, a teaspoon the only toy I had for him. He mouthed it with quiet joy. Was it an accident? She asked. He chose to take his own life, I said. The words hung in the air like dust that sparkles, then seems to disappear. What I did not say. Once we sat on this couch and read books, watched Peter Pan, built pirate forts with pillows, searched for Waldo, and snuggled when it rained. Once he too chewed on my teaspoons before he built computers and took AP statistics and helped me buy a Ford. They murmured, I'm sorry, because that is what people say when there is nothing else to say. When the talk soon turned to bonfires and building permits, I did not mind. It was enough to have acknowledged he was here. What I did not say, but somehow said, just because he's dead doesn't mean he's gone. We have 3 children, 2 daughters, and a son. Oh, friend, you know, there's the ambush, right? Where you just couldn't possibly know you're about to start weeping. And the ambush and I've become such good friends.
Which is why you have an entire roll of toilet paper with you.
That is why I have an entire roll of toilet paper. I also have realized, Sarah, that I don't mind crying at all. In fact, I think there was a time when I thought, if I'm going to cry, then I'm not going to read that poem. If I'm going to cry, then I'm not going to talk about this. Then I realized that those were the things that I most deeply wanted to talk about and they mattered the most. And I thought, okay, then I'm going to say them.
I'm going to say them and I'm going to bring my toilet paper.
That I'm bringing my toilet paper and I'm going to cry and I'm going to say these things that are the most important things to say. I'm not going to let tears stop me from being as real as possible.
Before you read this poem, Grace, will you share the context of the night it was about?
So there we were in Georgia. It was late at night, and I love walking late at night. And I always ask my kids if they would like to go walk with me, and they always said no. And this particular night, I said, hey, Finn, you want to come for a walk with me? And he said, yes. I was overjoyed. And so we were just walking around these dark streets in this very rural part of Rome, Georgia. Oh my goodness, he was so happy and easy and giddy. And we were having such a wonderful time talking about ridiculous things. And I was just so in love with that moment. And the poem I wrote that night was about that. Grace, what a loss it would be to not have been born. So I would have missed a Thursday night such as this, in which my son and I walk the dark streets in Georgia and watch the lightning transform the sky into pink flares and smell some sweet unnameable flower and talk about Dodge Chargers and knees and roaches. I swear, it has all been worth it. Every second of 51 years for this hour, in which there are no bells, no shoulds, no other tugs except to take the next step down the center line, while in the distance wraps another clap of thunder. It strikes me, Sarah, the gift I gave myself that I didn't know I was giving myself, writing this poem about just how wonderful it was to be with him just before he was no longer here. I remember just how true it was to that feeling of it's all been worth it just for this hour. Everything in my whole life has been worth it just to have that hour. Not that it was perfect. There was all this other stuff. And yet what was perfect was that we were so in it together, that we were so present in it and together. There was a sense, too, that I wrote about in that poem of something ominous coming. And I could feel that, of course, in him, he was so deeply unsettled and there was so much difficulty happening in his life right then, so much that was hurting him. That was also a part of that moment, you know, so that it was all of it and just being so present with it together. That was the gift. That was the gift. Still is.
Mm. It reminds all of us to hold those moments. Not that they're perfect, but that they are what they are when we're together in this physical form, you know?
Yeah.
What does a peaceful exit mean to you?
I guess it would be saying yes to the world as it is, being open to what's happening instead of in resistance, which is saying yes to mortality, yes to the gift of life, which is its opposite but necessary corollary. Yes to all the love and yes to the longing to not say goodbye. Yes to being here and yes to the mystery of what's also here that we have no idea yet. Yeah, I suppose a peaceful exit is flooded with that yes.
Well, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you for listening to Peaceful Exit. I'm your host, Sarah Cavanaugh. You can find me on Instagram at @apeacefulexit, and you can learn more about this podcast at peacefulexit.net. Our senior producer and editor is Katie Klein. Our sound engineer is Sean Simmons. Additional support from Cindy Gall and Sierra Austin. Original music provided by Ricardo Russell, with additional music and sounds from Blue Dot Sessions. If you'd like to support our show, please follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Rate and review us wherever you listen. It really does make a difference. And as always, thank you so much for listening.